This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow, what a treat it is for me today, because I get to talk to an author whose work I have admired for so long, and it is absolutely thrilling because one of her books I have to tell you about. After a while, we'll talk about this other book that she wrote. But first, I want to talk about her newest book called The Prince. And, you know, sometimes a book just comes along at the right time. And it was very strange. I was taking care of somebody in the hospital, and I had to spend a lot of time there. And I got this book, and I forgot everything. I just enjoyed it so much. It is called The Prince, and the author is Denisha Smith. Hi, Denisha.
Hello. I'm delighted to be on the show, and I'm very jealous that you guys are in Florida.
Oh, where are you?
Cold New York. I'm in New York City. Cold. We've had snow, and I'm very envious of people who've gotten to Florida, which I unfortunately haven't this time, but I'm here virtually, as they say.
Oh, it is just so glorious here. I feel so sorry for all you people. We're just having so much fun. I get to sit around the pool and read books, but I did read this book. It was funny. As it came at the right time. I was, you know, under a lot of pressure and just sort of all nervous. And then I got this book, and I will say that I got into the book, and I calmed down in a way that I just took a deep breath, and I was into the book, and you have done such a marvelous job with it. The other book I talked at the beginning, of course, is The Honeymoon, which oh my gosh, when I read that book, I couldn't believe it. It was so great. So let's talk. We'll first talk about your version of the prince, your prince. Okay. And then you can tell what it's based on. But then I'm going to keep you as long as I can today, because I really want to talk to you about Henry James.
Well, great. I'm delighted to talk about Henry James. My novel is called Prince, and it's a contemporary retelling of Henry James' great novel, The Golden Bull. His book was published in 1904. Very complicated language, which I love, but I cannot write that kind of language. So The Prince, which is the contemporary version, is told in ordinary English. The Prince is a novel about secrets, about family secrets, and how in a very wealthy family, and how the members of this wealthy family who've been cocooned by their wealth have to come to terms with this, which is at the ending of the novel. My idea being that all families have secrets. Most of us, you know, maybe have a crazy uncle or a sibling we didn't know about. And how do families deal with this? It's not a self-help book. It is a novel. It is a story, I hope with a degree of mystery.
Oh, yes.
I hope so. And so that was one of the subjects that interested me about James. And the way he told it, and I can go into that later, but in my novel, again, it's, I think, a story of these secrets, how they're embedded in the family, how, to what extent they gradually become aware of them. They're pretty terrible. It's pretty terrible, really, one big secret. And what do they do about it? And so that gives you a summary of the story, and I can go on from there.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit. Now, of course, it's set in America as opposed to, in Europe. But let's talk about, I love the island. That was so clever to use that, because that really, that also set it into a wonderful place just mentally when and one can envision the island. So explain how you, let's talk about Emily. She, you know, she's the main, you know, character here. We right away get involved with Emily. We want to like her, understand her, and then when she falls in love, it's surprising.
Well, yes. Okay, so we have here in the novel, I made this family up, the Woodfords. They're descended from the robber barons at the turn of the 20th century who made their wealth on the backs of the working man, and they were cruel people, often uneducated. Now their descendants, in my case, the made-up, the fictional Woodford family, are living off this great wealth. And my character, one of the main characters, is that he is the descendant, Henry, of this robber baron. And he, like a lot of robber barons, is interested in art. But he's also a public interest lawyer. He's very well aware of how bad his antecedents were. He has a beautiful, he's a widower. He has a beautiful, sweet, innocent daughter, Emily. And she, too, has been cocooned by this wealth. And along comes this impoverished Italian prince, Federico, who is, it's funny to think of an impoverished Italian prince, but in fact there are a number of impoverished royalty in Europe at this point. Their money's run out, or the taxes on their estates are so big. And I actually found a real-life one who is running a food cart that sold pizza in Los Angeles. It's true. So anyway, Federico is impoverished, doesn't know how he's going to take care of his aging mother. He becomes engaged to Emily. He marries her. He loves her. But...
That's where the but...
Right.
That's where it comes in. Well, you know, I... When I started reading it, of course, I had read, you know, Henry James. I went through the... You know, we all go through that, for book lovers, we all go through a phase where we either love Henry James or we hate Henry James, or we come back to Henry James.
Right.
And now, with you, you, of course, spent a great deal of your life in England.
That's right.
And I was obsessed with England. When I was 11 years old, I made the decision that I was going to move to England. I was from Northern Michigan. I was going to move to England and live near where Jane Austen was born.
Oh, I understand that. I grew up in an England that was very different from the England that exists now.
Oh.
Believe me.
I know.
When I was 13, but I've gone back. You know, I've gone back and it's not recognizable to me in certain ways. I grew up, my stepmother who raised me was English. I learned to read and write in England and to talk in England. And so coming here was kind of a culture shock. But I will say that in the case of the Woodfords, I did set this novel in America because it interested me, again, how the descendants of these robber barons live now, people like the Rockefellers. They become environmentalists, some of them become doctors, and I'm sure they're conscious of their antecedents. My Woodfords, you mentioned the island, which was one of my favorite parts of composing this novel. It's based on an island in Long Island Sound called Gardner's Island, which is owned by a family that really has nothing to do with my family and the prince, but it's this place of primeval beauty. Untouched. No one is allowed on it except the family. And it seemed a very interesting location for part of this novel because Emily, the girl with whom the prince falls in love or marries, she is herself an innocent. And part of the novel is about her loss of innocence. And I loved writing about this island. I composed it. One of my favorite parts of writing novels is to create worlds, different, you know, my own world. So that was fun. But anyway, there's a huge crisis in this family when the old girlfriend arrives. I don't know if you want me to.
No, we don't want. I don't want to. I don't want you to give away this because part of the fun of of all books, but particularly this one, is the reveal. Is what's going to happen. There's not a. The mystery is always underlying, and you're always have a little bit what's going to happen next. And so that builds up the excitement. So we're not going to say what's going to happen, but I knew the minute I was reading it, and I realized that you were having so much fun with the island. It was such a clever, I'm sure when you thought about you setting it in, it's contemporary. It's pre-COVID. Right. Thank goodness everybody's not wearing a mask.
Yes.
But the idea to set it in New York is one thing, but then that it's very clever what you thought of to do the island, because that set it apart from everything else.
Well, I think so. Of course, the island is only in the prints. It isn't in James's original novel. James's novel, though, is also set in these grand estates like a lot of his novels. But my island was fun because I had visited that island, one of the few people who's ever visited, because I was a journalist, and I knew it from a story I wrote about a huge battle between family members on Gardner's Island. And so I also researched the flora and the fauna, and I changed many elements from the real island, but it fascinated me that one family could own a six-mile-long island in Long Island Sound, the largest private island in Long Island Sound, almost their own kingdom, and nobody's allowed on it but them or their guests, or the once in a decade, a journalist. So, that was part of the story.
Well, I think it was perfect, and your world building there is fabulous. I felt like I was on that island, and I was enjoying it so much. The part of being a writer, when you find this idea, you get the idea for a story, and you create these characters. Now, your characters, we'll talk in a little while about Henry James, but just as a novel that, for somebody who's never read Henry James, doesn't know, have a clue, this is just on its own. It is so good. It is so really fascinating that,
thank you.
All the homage to Henry James is great, but I just want everybody to know that this novel, you don't have to know Henry James to really enjoy this novel.
You certainly don't have to know Henry James to enjoy The Prince, because it is my novel. And it had to stand on its own to make it work. That was, of course, a major goal. So I don't think you have to have read that novel at all. I had fun creating my own characters. I will say that, the novel turns on the entrance of Federico's old girlfriend, Christina, who happened to be a childhood friend of his wife, and they had had an affair unbeknownst to his wife, and it was a passionate affair. They couldn't get married because neither one of them had any money, and that's the turning point of the novel. What is going to happen now? How will they resolve it? Will they learn about what happened to the other members of the family, and to what extent do they want to know, and how long can they keep up the refusal to admit it? And that's the real crux of the novel.
And, of course, Federico, you also had fun doing the research. I'm sure you've been to Italy, so it was very, it's very well written, this part, making his world something that we could really imagine.
Well, I have been in Italy. I don't know it like the back of my hand, but I've been quite a few times to Rome. And one of the issues was to bring Federico into the contemporary world. Henry James' character is actually an impoverished prince, but now we're in the 21st century, and so in The Prince, it's set in the 21st century. So I had to understand what would have happened to Federico now at this point. As I said, the European aristocracy has many, many descendants who are very poor or who are poor or do ordinary things like their professors, college professors. So that was kind of fun. You know, I thought, well, who is this guy? Let him try to be a rock and roll or to have a hip-hop band, which, you know, young Italian people do. They love American music. They have their own bands. And then, okay, he doesn't have any money. How is he living? Well, he lives with his roommates. They smoke a lot of weed, like typical young people. He also has a good side. He's kind of a lost figure, which explains a bit how the marriage to the rich Emily evolves. He's a soccer fan, and he tries to help the migrant children. He helps in a soccer club. That Italy now, contemporary Italy, is filled with migrants especially from North Africa, who come across the Mediterranean. They have a terrible, terrible life there. They're hated. Most of the Romans hate them, and the police are brutal to them. So I let Federico volunteer as a coach for a soccer team made up of these homeless boys, and which is something he would do because, you know, he's got a good heart, and it's just that he's lost, and he's looking for an identity and for money to help his mother, and so he marries this rich girl, Emily.
Well, you know, we don't want to give too much away because, the thing is, when people are reading this book, I think they will immerse themselves and understand what you're talking about, you know, the entire idea of the secrets that are permeating throughout the novel, because it is true, as you say, every family has secrets, and in this family, one of the things that I think it is good in a way that, you know, you talk about here the way that really some of these, you know, there's been such a anti-rich people in this country, but rich people do so much good, and they do have developed over the years the caring about society that shows through your book.
Well, it's probably true. The Rockefellers fund huge numbers of organizations. The Ford family does. I was interested in the psychological turn of this, i.e., you have these descendants, again, who are very aware of their heritage. They're now educated people. They're surrounded by the results of their wealth. They try to come to terms with it morally. And, you know, you sort of wonder, well, we have a new class of great wealth in this country, the Zuckerbergs, the Bezoses, and how will their children cope or deal with the questions or the scandals and the questions about the moral qualities of their antecedents, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, who have been condemned for treating their workers badly, or in the case of Zuckerberg, for violating the honor and beliefs of our country in certain cases through Facebook. And so, you know, this is a very interesting moral question, and you're quite right. There is enormous wealth in our country. And what is the meaning of doing good?
Exactly.
What is doing good? Yes.
Or,
yes.
You know, when somebody who's wealthy does something like Isabella Stewart Gardner did, and she created this fantastic museum.
Yes.
Now that, if you're wealthy, if you do something like that, or what, you know, the Rockefellers have done, you know, for museums in New York, that is such a lasting gift to humanity that you've taken your wealth and you've used it for something that's lasting and that preserves beauty. I admire that so much. And so
less true of the Vanderbilts as well as the Rockefellers.
Exactly.
And Isabel Stewart Gardner, her beautiful museum.
Oh, I love that.
And it's very, historically, it was very common for these families especially the women, they collected art. They brought it back from Europe instead of postcards in the early days. And they created the foundations for many of the great museums that we have now. And it's a way, I think, of also dealing with their guilt at you know, coming from these families. None of the original people in those families were very nice people, including the original Vanderbilt. You know, they cheated their workers, they exploited them. And now the descendants make these beautiful art museums. They collect beautiful things. They help artists, you know, Peggy Guggenheim in Venice. So this is an interesting solution to whatever guilt they might feel.
Yeah, well, we have that right here in Florida, in Sarasota. We have the Ringling Museum, that Mabel Ringling was a great art collector. And we have a beautiful museum here that it's so gorgeous. It's fantastic. And so, yeah, you know, they can do a lot with their money. And we hope that they do something that's lasting like this. Now, what I'm going to have to do in a little while, I'm going to have to take a commercial. But when I come back, I want to talk about really how you got the idea of taking Henry James, the Golden Bowl, which, you know, some people consider it his absolute masterpiece.
Yes.
I just realized yesterday that it was the 106th anniversary of his death yesterday. He died on February.
Gosh, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, he died on February 28th. February 28th. Absolutely, I remember it because
more
it
about
was
him than I do.
Yeah, well, I sort of always know about people who were born on or died on the 29th, and I remember that he died before he didn't get to leap year. So, that was, you know, he made such an impact on American literature.
Yes.
And for us, those of us who, you know, I lived in England for quite a few years. You lived in England. Of course, he went there. I think when you've lived in England, you have sort of a different idea of America. And so his impact from what he did, he was an incredible talent. And the volume of his work is enormous.
Yes.
Really fantastic. And of course, we'll talk about that. And I want to talk about that moment that you got that inspiration for that moment. Okay?
Right.
Now, I have to do some commercials. You're not.
I'll take a break. Okay.
You take it. Don't hang up because we're going to come back and we're going to really concentrate. And I know a lot of my listeners have not read Henry James yet. But. Boy, oh boy, they are in for a treat if they get into it. And we'll talk about his use of metaphors. I don't think anyone uses metaphors quite so well. So let's take a commercial break, and you hold on, okay?
Okay, I'll be there. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist? an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my very special guest today, Denisha Smith, an Emmy Award-winning author who is the author of her newest book is called The Prince, and then I'm going to also talk to her about The Honeymoon, and maybe we'll throw in a few of her other books. Thank you for holding on, Denisha. It's so nice to have you on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well,
I wish I were down there, but never mind.
Well, whenever you get down here, you can come to the studio. You know, let's take a step back. You've written The Prince, which is based on, well, inspired, not based on, inspired by,
yes,
a work of Henry James, which most people, or I think it's been selected as like one of the 100 greatest novels, I think, by I don't know how many different groups of people, The Golden Bowl. Can you tell us, when did you read it first, and when were you inspired to write your book?
Well, I did read it several years ago. I can't even remember when. I loved it. Then, you know, this is one of the mysteries. I can always tell you, almost always, why I wrote a certain novel. This is my fifth novel. And I cannot tell you exactly why I decided to base a novel on it. I was probably looking through my bookshelf, seeing that novel I had loved, and thinking about it, going back to read it, and realizing that this novel could be updated to our time, that the story of wealth, of loss of innocence, of family secrets could be made into a novel for the modern world. That's the best I can do. Whereas with my other novels, almost always there was a reason I wrote it. And, you know, I could pinpoint that moment. But here, it came out of a love, and I probably thought to myself, in fact, I did, to write a new novel, The Prince, I was going to have to immerse myself in James again and read this book very carefully again and again, by the way, to find out what is he doing. And in doing that rereading, I was further, I further admired and loved the mystery in it and how you read it almost, this is the old Henry James, as if you were reading a mystery story. And I can only explain it that way. And also, like every, as I've said, a lot of families have secrets. And, of course, my family had secrets, which I'm not going to tell you. How do families learn about them? How do they resolve them? What happens when the knowledge becomes apparent? And so that's the best way I can answer this with regard to this novel, The Prince.
Well, that's, you know, Henry James is famous for how he really could get into people and understand the psychology, and of course so much of the people who have read his books, there's always this romance element, this underlying tension. When were you reading Henry James? I remember sort of my first time I read the very first book I read, I think, was A Portrait of a Lady. And I remember, I think in high school, they had us read The Turn of the Screw. But yes. Were you a fan of Henry James over the years?
Yes. You know, like a lot of people, my first Henry James novel was Washington Square, and then The Turn of the Screw, the story, and my favorite short story of all time, The Beast in the Jungle. And then I imagine that The Golden Bull may have come to me in college, which is where I read those books. Or I may have taken it on myself, which was my habit, certainly in my 20s, I didn't read Proust until I had left college. I read him for the first time in my 20s. I think I liked the challenge of these particular authors, these two. That drew me in, and I read The Golden Bull as an adult in recent years. I remember reading it with my husband, or I told him about it, and he read it, and we discussed it. Then, again, most lately, I think I began this novel a couple of years ago. It took me the shortest amount of time of any of my novels, and I think I was probably looking at my bookshelf, remembering Henry James fondly, taking it out, remembering how much I'd loved it, thinking about what he was doing, and could I render this into the contemporary world? And I think that's about the only way I can describe it. Like, I had, you know, again, I've had other novels where it would be easier to tell you exactly what was going on in my head.
But, well, and thank goodness you didn't write 580 pages.
That's another thing. It's very short. It's
yes.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. Well, of course, his writing is, when you said you didn't write it like him, well, not many people can write it like him. His sentences are so complex.
Yeah.
And there are so many subclauses and subclauses to subclauses.
Yes.
And it's, but it works. You know, when you're reading it, you go these long sentences. You, nowadays, of course, probably Microsoft Word would just stop you and say, yes, don't write this.
Don't do this.
Oh, I
correct all the time.
Oh, I hate when they do that. I don't, you know. So many, I get a lot of, you know, authors who are just starting off, indie authors, and they are using, well, I was going to say Microsoft Word that corrects their words and says, do you like to use this or don't you think you should say this? Oh, I hate that. I mean, I hate that.
It homogenizes language in a way that we the glory of the English language is its variety, its possibilities. The way it's constantly changing. And I agree with you totally. I would tell writing students to stay away from it. You write what you want.
Oh, exactly. Use any word you want, whatever comes to your head. Don't let this stupid computer just...
Yeah, trust yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You have to trust yourself. But, you know, as a somebody, what would he have thought of it?
He, I'm not sure I would have entirely liked him as a man.
No.
I could love his work, but I see him as this rather fusty bachelor who hung out with a lot of rich people, who had a great deal, though, of enormous talent, powers of observation that were extraordinary. He noticed everything around him. He noticed the manners and mores of his crowd, who were a lot of very wealthy people, a lot of gay men, and he was, you know, I couldn't do what he does. And I will tell you that when I'm writing and I'm reading him at the same time, his style sometimes infects my writing, and it's terrible because I can't really do it. So in regard to the new book, The Prince, I fell back a bit on my experiences as a reporter for the New York Times, where I learned at its best to tell a story in clean language, plain language, not to inculcate it with these curlicues, these elaborate long paragraphs, these inferences, which are the glory of Henry James' work, but not in The Prince. So there you have it.
Exactly. Well, you know, the fun of going back, you know, of course, also read all of those books when I went through that period where I read all of his books. I'm the kind of person, I never forget, one of the assignments was in school was was to read a certain author, and I came back from spring break and I had read every book that the author had ever written, and the teacher was like, "What?" I said, "Well, yeah, that's what I do when I get excited about an author. I read every book because I like to see the development. I like to see how they progress, or how they change, or sometimes they get worse. You never know."
But say that you sound like a very shrewd reader.
And it's so much fun to now for me, even now. It's although I get 10, 20 books a week from publishers, I still go back and reread certain books. Just 2 years ago, I went back to Proust. I just had to. One of the wonderful things, I love that you said you read part of it to your husband. I did the same thing because there were times, my husband didn't have time for a long book or he's a businessman, he's busy, but I would read sections and he loved that.
Reading aloud is one of the, to another person, is one of the great joys, and it's something we don't do a lot of. But when we were children, our parents read us stories or read us bedtime stories. And now, as adults, if you repeat that and read to a partner, there's something wonderful about doing it and hearing it. It's just a lost custom, I think. And so it's interesting to know that you did it. And I have done it at times with my husband, too. I introduced him to James. He is an historian, and he had not read a lot of fiction, but now he's actually, I think, even a better reader than I am. But I appreciate that scene of reading aloud to someone. It's, it's wonderful.
It is, and I wish more people would do it because, as I said, now my husband was Israeli, so although he could read, his English was, of course, perfect, but he didn't read a lot of particularly, novels. It wasn't his thing. So I did have to, and how we managed... We lived in Europe, and I could get him to take me to any place. We traveled all around Europe. All I would have to do is say, well, a book took place here, and when we get there, I would read to him, and I would I would read him parts of, a book. And he would take me anywhere I wanted to go, and we traveled all over the place, and partly because I would always turn it into a story. And people really should do that. I think it connects you very, very much.
I have a habit when I'm in Rome. I remember being in a hotel room reading Portrait of a Lady, and I often read Henry James when I am in Rome particularly. And I don't know why I have this habit, except I feel the company next to me of this American person. I see the world through his eyes temporarily, and it's very fascinating, although I am within that country. But I've noticed the same habit that you're describing, and I have to think about that, what that means.
I know. Well, I'm glad you said Portrait of a Lady, because that was my first Henry James, and after that, I got sort of hooked on it. It's so wonderful when for, people who really love reading. Sometimes I get so depressed that our schools don't let people read. So when for a book like your book about George Eliot, The Honeymoon, I have to tell people about this book. Now, in American schools, I don't think you went to high school here, but in American schools, they give people George Eliot and they say, read it,
Oh, God, yes.
And they don't. There's no context. There's no understanding. And everybody turns... Well, actually, American schools tend to turn kids away from reading because they give the worst books and,
Silas Marner.
Yeah.
How many kids have had to wade through Silas Marner, which you there's no way a ninth grader is going to appreciate that book, which is actually a great book. It's just not for that age group. And I think it's turned many, many a student away from George Eliot, believe me.
It turned many away from just reading because they figured, if this is what you're going to get, I'm going to get. I'm not going to read. I mean, I knew high school. I knew kids in high school. Now, when I was reading Proust, actually, when I was in high school, so I was already, you know, I was way, way ahead. Well, I was way ahead of all of the teachers. But, you know, I remember when they gave that book, and particularly the boys, I mean, that was it. That was like the end of their reading life.
This is a big problem, because you're introducing them to potentially great literature, but it's the wrong time or the wrong way. And I think it's a big issue. It was a big issue when I was in school. I actually went to high school in America, but in British schools, it's always a problem. What do you do? How do you make these kids want to read and then prepare them to read later what some would consider a great novel? You know, I think this is an issue, and I don't quite know how people solve it now.
Well, you know, they went through this period where they said, oh, well, the kids aren't going to read anyway. But then they would get a 600-page Harry Potter book, and yes, they would read that. They don't hesitate to read that. You just have to have it at the right time and with the right attitude and not try to shove Silas Marner. And you're right, it's good. You know, it's a good book, but it's not, of course, it's not Middlemarch. But
it's been said that Harry Potter has introduced a generation of children to the joys of reading and maybe prepared them for later reading. And I think that's great.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Go on.
So I wanted to tell everyone that we've been talking about The Prince, which is a fantastic book. It's the newest one by Denisha. But Denisha, let's for a minute talk about The Honeymoon, because I tell you, it was really a book that really, when I got it, I was so thrilled with it, because I, of course, love Middlemarch, and I had been actually doing Joy on Paper. I'm coming up to the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And I had been doing it since 2015, and that book came out in 2016. Now, I read it, you know, while I had the program, but I still didn't have all the connections to publishers and agents now that I do today. Right. Yep. So I didn't have you on. But I remember when I read it and I thought, oh, wow, where has she been all my life? This is just so good.
Well, thank you very much. I you know, I was very happy to have written that novel. I must tell you, I really was. And I love talking about it if you want to.
Oh, yeah, please talk about it.
Well, that you ask how that came about. When I was beginning to become a novelist, there weren't many women ahead of me who had children. And there were only women who, you know, sometimes they were married, but not always happily. But the question in my mind was, and of course the literary heroine for a lot of us was George Eliot. So I was interested in her life. She was also a very homely, as they would put it, person. She married, or she didn't marry, a wonderful man who sustained her, encouraged her. But then when he died, she married this much younger man, very handsome. He was rich. She was the most famous writer in the English language. And she went on this honeymoon with him to Venice. And he had adored her. He was a friend of the family. And he tried to commit suicide. He jumped off the balcony of their hotel. And nothing. They kept it secret. They just said Johnny, as his name was, John Cross, he had been ill. He was recovering. The only open account of it that I knew of was in the Italian papers. This tourist had tried to commit suicide, but rescued by the gondoliers. That stuck with me. You know, that. What was the mystery of that marriage? What, the marriage was mysterious. What did these two people want from each other? Who was George Eliot in the context of love and romance. And that brought me, and so little was known about this, and what I did in the novel was imagine what had happened without ever going contrary or ever being contrary to the known truth, so that I even researched the architectural renderings of her home so I would get the space right. I researched everything I could find about John Cross, who was actually came from a banking family, a Scottish banking family. And, you know, not much was known about him. But so from the true things, the few facts I could find, I built a novel. And I went to the hotel where he supposedly jumped off from. And that was creating that world was interesting, and trying to understand from her letters, from the letters he wrote, from the accounts of friends who observed them, what was this marriage about? Trying to figure it out. And there you have it.
Well, I think it is just fabulous. It is so good. Well, you know, one of the things that I do here on Joy and Paper, I try to expand my listeners' horizons so that they just get out there and try different books, because you never know what book will just strike the right chord in you. As a, you know, if you're a writer already, or if you're not a writer, that you get ideas and you get just this feeling that, yeah, you know, this book is really great. It's done something for my head. I really learned something. I've become not necessarily a better person, but a more informed person and a more full person just from reading a book. And this is why I like to talk always to authors, not just about the current books, but to remind my listener that the authors who wrote some really great books before. And the nice thing about, you know, nowadays, you know, thanks to, you know, online sellers, we can get these books. In the old days, I used to have to scour secondhand bookstores.
About it. Yeah, that's one of the good things that's come out of Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the other online venues for books. It's one of the things it's made. One of the things that e-books has made possible is you feel this whim, oh, I want to reread Edith Wharton. And you should go to a bookstore to get it, but if it's late at night and you can't get there, you can download it.
Exactly, exactly.
You can find reading online. And, I mean, many people prefer to hold the book in their hands. Sometimes they do both, by the way.
Exactly. So I want to tell people about The Prince, which is available at today's the release date, and a fantastic book. And then they have to read The Honeymoon, a novel of George Eliot. It really puts George Eliot sort of into the right perspective, I think, so people will understand her and not get terrors when they think of Silas Marner.
Thank you very much.
Because you did a fabulous job in that. Well, all of your writing, of course, is exquisite. You're so talented. You're so amazing. And, you know, I like to tell people to just get out there and try different books. And one of the, I've been really happy coming up with the 7th anniversary. I talked to people about for a couple of years, I kept saying, well, read Charlotte Bronte's The Professor. It's a really good book.
Yes, yes.
You know, and nobody had read it. And even, you know, people who were well-read had never read it. And I said, read it. It's just so good. It's so good. And so that's what I try to do here on Joy and Paper, get people to, you know, get out there and read and have this wonderful joy. And I'm glad that you also use the word joy in your conversation, because...
Yes.
That's what
brought me joy today, and I hope we meet if I ever come.
Oh, I'd love it. You know, two weeks ago, I had on my program Eugenia Lovett West, who was celebrating her 99th birthday.
Oh, I love it.
And she is a fantastic author. She has a wonderful book called Sarah's War, and she's 99 years old. And
she just published it. Is that the case?
Huh?
Did she just publish that book?
Yeah, it's she's amazing, and she last year she published a book about cybercrime, and she's 99, and she was on the program, and we were talking about D-Day like it was yesterday. So
we must I must now look up this book. I'm extremely excited to read these books, and I'm going to write her name down.
That's what I want to do. I want to connect writers to writers and readers to find these wonderful authors. And now that they have found you, Denisha Smith, I think you are fantastic. It's just an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
You're an amazing talent.
Okay.
Do you have a website or something? Everybody
has. It's Denisha, by the way, is the pronunciation of my name. It's Denisha.
Denisha.
Everybody gets it wrong. My kids call me Dementia. So.
Oh, well.
It's Denisha, D as in Detroit, I-N-I-T-I-A. That's three I's and a T, and it begins with a D, and then Smith is the easy part, .com. DenishaSmith.com.
Okay, well, thank you again for being on Joy on Paper today. You are an absolute joy. And everybody, get the prints. It's just a book that'll take you away to an island and a nice, nice story. Okay?
Thank you very much. Talk to you later.
Okay, great. Bye-bye now. Wow. What a writer. She's amazing. Her writing is so good. I didn't have time. I was going to play Jim Land's Literary Gems. He's done one on metaphors. And if you ever want an example of metaphors, you have to read The Golden Bowl. This book has, it has a river of metaphors just going, floating through that entire 580 pages. So if you're ever up to really doing a research on metaphors, you have to get Henry James' The Golden Bowl. It's a challenge, but it's worth it. And if you want, I know it's a little bit cheating, but you might want to get the Audible version too. And I might actually ask the Audible narrator to come on the program and read parts of it. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to invite her to come on because she did a great job, and it must have been a challenge to read 580 pages. So I think I'll do that. And I don't remember her name. Catherine Kilgren, I think. Anyway, she read the book, and it's really fantastic. And so I think I'll have her on. And meanwhile, everybody, oh, wow, this time has gone so fast. And I just want to, again, always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And I'm really hoping they pick up the Haunted Haven series, because this is exciting. I love this series set here in Florida. It'll bring people here, because people like to go and visit the places that are talked about in a book, and we like tourists here in our area of St. Petersburg, Clearwater, Florida. And boy, Carol J. Perry has written a great book, and it's Haunted Haven Mystery Series, and the first book is Be My Ghost, and it is available online, and she's finished up the second book, and we'll be hearing a release date for that one. Okay, everybody, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He saluted me. I saluted him because I should have been a general. Oh, boy. They needed me. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.